This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Mull Mansfield, let me tell you what we're going to be talking about. An estimated 4 out of every 10 grade 1 pupil in South Africa drops out of school before reaching matric. For those organizations and individuals working on the front line of dropout prevention, early intervention is key. And of course it's key because you've got to begin to pick up those problems pretty early before they become just, you know, permanent and you lose that particular child in the system. The early warning signs of dropping out of school: poor academic performance, behavioral problems, chronic absenteeism tend to appear at a young age. Let me bring Merle Mansfield into the conversation. Merle, just like the rest of us and everybody else, load shedding is an issue. How are you doing?
Good evening, Denzel. Good evening to your listeners. I'm literally hanging on by a thread after many hours of load shedding today.
you don't have those things on the roof, Merle. Why don't you have those things on the roof?
Those things on the roof cost money, Denzel. Do you want to sponsor some for me?
No, that's exactly the answer, the why I also don't have them on my roof, Merle. That's exactly the same reason. Merle, the whole issue of dropout during the school system and dropping out, at an alarming rate. And it for me, it seems to be, as much as we're trying to cap it and we're capturing it, sometimes, you know, I just feel sometimes we're losing the battle, because then if it's not COVID, it's something else. And if it's not the economy, you know, where people just can't afford and other things, and people are forced out and, you know, societal issues, and we look at behavioral issues at the moment, then it just seems like all the factors build up. And more and more, there are more and more reasons for people just to then begin to you know, pack up and say, why do I need this? And for parents to then to have an understanding of that decision that's taken, you know, for somebody to drop out of school. So in essence, sometimes one begins to think that, you know, we're beginning to normalize it. And I'm hoping that you're going to tell me that we haven't normalized this particular conversation yet. We're not there yet.
Well, I think it's really interesting in the way that you've just framed it, because, you know, when you look at the stats and you see all of these factors that you're just talking about and how learners are struggling through school, the one thing that always stands out for me is how many times learners try to come back before they drop out.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that there's this hopefulness among South African youth and young people who are engaged in school when they are still engaged in school, that they will complete, that they will accomplish something, you know, that they will leave with the matric certificate, that they'll enter something post-school. And so it really comes harsh in kind of a stark difference in terms of how people perceive young people often, you know, that they are lazy, they don't want to perform, they're not engaged. And so I think, you know, when I look at those statistics and I see something like, for example, 20% of the kids who are in our senior phase or FEP phase in our no-fee schools are 3 or more years overage for their grade. Now, that tells me that they've already repeated once, twice or thrice before getting to the FET phase, but they still came back.
Yeah.
So, and that for me is the interesting thing, and it's where the opportunity lies in our education system and in our country to really serve learners and to really serve young people, and to take that interest and that willingness to come back and to battle and put in place the support that is required to keep learners in school. I don't think the idea is normalized, because every time I say to people that 40% of kids drop out of school, there is outrage. But I don't think that there's an understanding of the extent or the scale of risk that exists within South Africa for learners to drop out of school.
You mentioned two things: the dreadful, and you mentioned that they try to come back. And then you know, for me, almost when I think of that, and I think somebody who's about to drop out and the kind of turmoil that goes on in their head at that particular point, because, you know, finishing your schooling program means, you know, continuing in that particular vein potentially. And then also it just means employment. And a lot of those kids are looking at people who are unemployed, and they understand what that that the whole aspect of dropout means. So I can understand that they would fight to return at some particular point, because looking at that unemployment queue, looking at uncles, aunts, mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters who are unemployed, you are starkly reminded of where you're going to be. And then the other one, of course, will, you know, one ultimately does want to achieve something. And at the end of the day, you know, you do, you know, we personalize that particular aspect. So how important do you think is that process within, you know, we can engage those particular children, those particular kids, that particular youth, you know, in conversations about, you know, don't drop out, this or that, but within their own space, they might have, they probably have a terrifying, you know, conversation with themselves about dropping out and what it means.
Absolutely. I always say that the global research shows us, our research in the country shows us that dropout never happens as an instantaneous event. Very, very, very few cases where you find learners who say, I woke up one day and I decided I'm not going back to school. It's often, you know, this long process that happens over many years where a learner starts feeling disengaged. That disengagement keeps spiking, and it's impacted by a number of factors that they are navigating within their lives, sometimes within their home, sometimes within their community, sometimes within their health, and then sometimes academically within their school. And all of those factors pile up. And often we don't notice them, we don't pick them up, and we don't respond to them. And then eventually the disengagement is so heightened, the learner drops out of school. Now, for me, there's all these opportunities in between. And those moments when learners are having moments of crisis that at the moment we aren't channeling well. So, for example, we aren't able to pick up teens in our school in a good way at the moment if we look at just data at the national level. So if I'm saying learners are repeating at high rates in grade 4, grade 10, and grade 7, I can't tell at the moment if the same learners who are repeating are the ones who are dropping out, because our data cannot tell us that, right? I can't tell if a learner is repeating and moving to a different school, where that learner's gone, specifically if they've moved to a different province. So I can't send any information to another school on how to support a learner that's leaving my school, you know, which I think is a critical aspect of kind of continuous care and support for a child in school. If a learner has failed and you're in a class that's already overcrowded, our policy is very clear. A learner is supposed to have an individual development plan that is developed with the learner and the parents on what we're going to do to help this learner catch up on whatever it is that they've missed that's now made them fail or that's made them progress, meaning they've been pushed through to the next year. In many of our schools, there's no capacity and there's no time to put those, you know, plans into place. So when you're sitting in a class with 60 other children and you are already 2 years behind, it's very likely that you are not even seen. You know, you're not keeping up. You're not heard. And so I think the experience of school for many of our children is one that is not nice. It's one that makes them feel even less valued. And often that contributes to the disengagement and the decision to leave school. We've seen from the interventions that we've done in some of the provinces that we've worked that as soon as there's some kind of intervention and we're picking up these signs at an early stage and we put critical support in place, that there is shifts in learners' perceptions of school, in learners' engagement with school, and their ability to then navigate the issues that they have and that they are facing. We can't change the life circumstance, but we can certainly change what we are expecting or asking learners to do on their own often. You know, many learners don't have parents. Within our country, many learners are being raised by caregivers, you know. We also have situations where there are learners who are dealing with very difficult circumstances in their households, where there are things expected of them, you know, that seems unreasonable in other households that maybe are more affluent. And so I think we need to consider how we come around our children in a way that allows them to participate in education in a way that is meaningful for them. And not just, you know, education is happening to me. and that's the experience of many learners. You know, it's not really something I'm part of. It's just this is something that that's happening to me. And eventually it's too much for me to handle and I stay away from it. And so we need to change that narrative and start thinking about it differently.
You raised the issue of the collecting and collating of accurate, detailed, regular data. So once you've got that, who is responsible for that particular space? Because, you know, you've got the Department of Education, that's the formal institutionalized, component. You've got a lot of people like yourself and organizations that work in this particular space. And you know, I would assume amongst all of the role players, somewhere, someplace, somebody would say, as you've pointed out and said, data is an issue. You know, we're not collecting enough data. Why, with all the conversations around this particular topic, is the one thing that's so key to the conversation the one lacking aspect, the collection of the data?
So I think, we've been really advocating for this for the past years. And I want to say that in South Africa, we actually have really great data systems. We have great monitoring systems. Mm. You know, our tools are fantastic. I think that there are gaps in our data. And that has to do with how we can collect it from the ground. And that's often impacted by where schools are situated, what they have access to, some schools, in the rural KZN where we've worked before, there's one laptop that one teacher is filling in for every class, attendance data, for example, on that school. So I think there are real barriers to kind of really instituting data collection, manpower, around really inputting data in a succinct way and collecting absenteeism. You know, can you imagine how overwhelming it is for a teacher in grade five in Gunubi? There's a classroom in grade five where there's 80 children sitting in front of her and she has to do roll call. That's crazy. So I think really thinking innovatively about how the data is collected and why and what we're using that information for. But secondly, it is the analysis of data that is missing. Mm. The analysis of data and the presentation of data in a way that is a true reflection of what it's like to flow through school in South Africa, and also really explaining to the public what this means. So we often hear that our school completion rates are getting better, right? So more learners are completing school.
Mm.
But we don't talk about what our repetition rate looks like. And I think that there's a real story behind that. Why is it taking learners, 15 to 18 years to complete school for those who actually make it to grade 12? And then there are those who go through 13 years of school, get to grade 10, and actually drop out and leave with nothing.
Mm.
No certificate, no kind of signaling tool to any kind of post-school opportunity in terms of what they're able to do. And I think that is critically important.
Mm.
So as much as we celebrate, what a small proportion of learners are able to accomplish in our education system, a large majority of our learners are actually not able to attain the level of schooling or, exit schooling with the level of qualification that allows them to, go into the post-school opportunities in a easy or simple way.
Mm.
And that's really impacting on youth unemployment. It really impacts on the longitudinal outcomes of mental health and economic participation for young people in our country. And eventually, it becomes a public health issue. It becomes a public health concern. We have advocated for the introduction of a KPI, dropout being an actual national KPI within the Department of Basic Education's portfolio.
Mm.
And it has since been included. And we await, reports against this KPI. So we wait a year, like we report annually on the matric results, for example, and how provinces are performing against academic, subjects.
Mm.
We would like dropout to be included as one of the things that we report against.
That wouldn't be politically correct, because that would be to talk to a different aspect, and I can understand from a political conversation, why some things are maybe just not touched on, and then the 80 and 90% are spoken about, but when it comes to some of the other detail, it's not spoken about. But let me ask you if you'll agree with me, Mo. The government, when you look at budgets, the government does seem to put a lot of money into the schooling space, whether it be, NSFAS and looking after what happens when you're finished with school or through the schooling system. And I heard, the minister or the MEC is unhappy about the feed scheming, the food feed scheming in KZN at this particular point. So, you know, a lot of money does go into, you know, the department. There can't really be a criticism of that. You know, it might not be enough money, but there's a lot of money that goes into this education space. So, you know, for a country of South Africa's capacity with the kind of money we throw at the education system, is there an oblong, is there a balance that we're not getting right? Because, you know, you throw a lot of money at it, and we should, you know, into the schooling systems. And yet we do say we get, you know, reasonable results out of that. But four out of 10 people who don't make it is a huge number. That's just one number less than 5 out of 10, and that's half.
So I think if we really critically look at how the budget is allocated, we'll see that there's a lion's share of the budget allocated to staffing.
Yeah, right? Salaries and the likes.
Salaries and the likes, right? So that's one thing, and that's one resource within a school space. And those salaries are often teachers, right? So that's the basic minimum. We're not talking about any support staff, really, in an extended way. We're not talking about any kind of critical speciality teaching in any way. We're not talking about anything like educational psychologists for assessments of learners with learning difficulties and learning barriers, for example. We're not talking about aides in classrooms for learners who require support to write, to read. We're not talking about... So there's a number of gaps when we're looking at actually how we facilitate education within our space. And if we consider the majority of the learners we serve within our country, the backgrounds they are coming from, and many of the learners who would need the additional support are in school spaces that don't even have the basic support in place in a functional way often. And so I think there are big question marks around whether or not, you know, the spend is actually meeting the demand that exists within the space. And that's one of the key things, you know. So if we really thought about how much money we're putting in, I think we really need to think about how that money is being invested and whether or not we're getting the right return on investment for what we are putting into the education system.
Because
I must also qualify this by saying that we do have incredible teachers in our country. I really don't like the narrative that our teachers aren't good, because I think that we do see a lot of teachers who come and do above and beyond, you know, what is expected of them to perform in the classroom. But I think that trying to do that in a space with no support mechanisms around you can be, you know, impossible and very demoralizing.
And that brings me to a conversation that sits right next to the one about finances and teachers and where the money goes. Is that, you know, and like you said, now there's a lot of teachers who actually do good, and the majority of teachers are actually doing good. They go to work every day and they're producing the kind of results that we're seeing. But there's also the issue of school and culture. And what's happening at our schools, and you know, in the main, people begin to talk about, you know, the relationship between that teacher and that particular pupil, and we see violence at some points, you know, erupting, and schools sometimes are just, you know, drug areas where people take advantage of these children, and they've become war zones. So bullying and physical punishment and teacher absenteeism. How much of an impact does that particular school culture also have on dropping out? Because once it doesn't become a pleasurable thing, you know, I'm not going to hang around if I have already got problems of household income and I have, you know, the aspect of where I'm located is rural and it's geography that's an issue, and I might be, you know, throw in disability as well. If I'm already suffering from those particular elements and the school environment is one whereby, you know, it's not a happy place. It just adds to the whole aspect of me not wanting to be there. And if anything goes wrong, you know, one of my first options is to leave.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I'm always so critically aware of is that schools is the one place in this country where we can access every citizen, because every child in this country has the right to basic education. And we have almost 100% enrollment rate, like, you know, like a registration rate, like for learners going to school, starting school, people go. So there's this huge opportunity that exists in that, right? That school spaces actually become this place where we are able to impact the lives of South Africans in a way where we get to model the kind of society we want.
Mm.
And, you know, where we get to show learners, you know, what it can feel like and look like to be in a space where you are loved and cared for,
mm.
and where you can participate and where you are seen as a human being. And also for teachers to have that experience as well.
Mm.
And so I think culture is one of the things that actually speak really loudly to combating disengagement.
Mm.
In school spaces where there is barely nothing in terms of infrastructure, but you find that learners are coming and they will say, they sing the praises of the school.
Mm.
But look, I love my school. I love my teachers.
Mm.
Why? Because the experience of the school, regardless of what it looks like, you know, or regardless of where it's situated, is such that it gives them a positive experience with education.
Mm.
And so I think that that is something that is possible, that we can live and that we can do. It requires intention, though. We have to be intentional about it. It has to be something that becomes part of our vocabulary, not just in a way that we are offering it lip service and saying, yes, this is a school in which we serve children, you know, but actually we don't. And so the decision-making around how we serve children is important. For example, learners who come late to school, we're not locking the gates and leaving them outside because we understand that that learner's had a very difficult journey. Maybe they've had to catch two taxis to get there.
Mm.
Maybe they've had to wait for a gang fight to finish before they could walk across the field.
Yeah.
Do you know
or
what
walk,
I'm saying?
Or walk 10 kilometers to get there, 15 maybe,
exactly.
20. Yeah.
Exactly. So the school's policy speaks to serving the population of that school.
Mm.
You know, if we're talking about, we are not going to do corporal punishment within our school, but we also understand that corporal punishment includes shouting at learners.
Mm.
It includes name calling of learners.
Mm.
It includes
insulting,
dehumanizing learners and insulting learners. If we really start really getting to the nitty-gritty and saying, actually, we're going to model for learners, you know, what it could look like and feel like to be in a space where you are seen. I mean, that could just shift the whole experience of education in such a dramatic way.
Mm.
You know, if we're thinking about having no tolerance on bullying and actually being quite clear of what that looks like within our school, that if a child, you know, sees something, you know, even if they say, oh, I didn't mean to say that, you know, that what that looks like, there's a punishment attached to, you know, how do we, you know, reinforce better relationships or interpersonal relationships with our learners.
Mm.
And so that requires critical thinking, it requires actual intention, and it requires application of those practices every day and of those behaviors. The simple thing of greeting each other when we walk past each other, because we're seeing each other and we're noticing each other. These, you know, little, you know, actions amplify this feeling and this culture, and then the inclusion of the society and the community that's around our schools.
Mm.
You know, before COVID, I realized that many of our schools are still operating by sending a letter home in the child's bag that goes to the parent to tell the parent something. And when COVID hit, there was this whole big problem around how do we get hold of parents? We don't have numbers for parents.
Mm.
You know, oh, the children aren't coming to school. We can't send them a letter. And so I think there's like, it really opened up for me this whole space around what we call parental involvement. And, you know, another project in our work is called Teachers Can, and they're actually doing a lot of work. I mean, Parent Power, they're doing a lot of work talking about what is engagement versus involvement. Because, you know, involvement is framed in a particular way. We want parents to do this. We want parents to do that. And engagement looks different. Like, it's like we're consulting with parents. We're co-creating with parents. We're including parents. And so I think really starting to shift the way in which education and schools operate within communities to not just outwardly communicate, but also allow for feedback loops, but also allow for engagement, but also allow for involvement to look different and create spaces that are then safe for schooling communities. Because once the community owns the school, they will protect the school.
Mm.
The school won't have to do much to protect the school. Children will be protected.
Mm.
I went to school on the Cape Flats in one of the most notorious gang areas. And I can tell you now that when it was school hours, we could walk to school because the community would not allow gangsters to shoot while we were walking to school.
And
it was an interesting thing for us, you know, to see that. We all knew that during this time and this time, children were walking to school and we were allowed to go to school and we were allowed to get back home. And so I think there is opportunity for us to think about how we do education and school culture in a way that allows the experience of school to be a lot more positive.
Sure.
And that is really one of the biggest ways in which we can combat disengagement.
Merle, you talk a lot about disengagement, and I was just going to say, as you entered with disengagement, I was gonna pick up on that and just say I was gonna pick up on it anyway and say you talk a lot about disengagement. How do we relate that to the reintegration strategies? Because disengagement is one thing, and it's a child begins to disengage, and various aspects lead to that, and you slowly begin to disengage, and you get to a point where you're making life-changing decisions now. How do you get to a point whereby and I don't want to get into a conversation how you intervene and stop that particular aspect because you've been able to make an intervention. Just the disengagement aspect once it's there, and the reintegration strategies. How do they relate? Because reintegration, to bring a child back into the system, for me, seems the harder part. Even though you say that there's a lot of students who really, really do want to, come back, and they try to come back again, and the numbers there are looking good. But once they've, disengaged, that reintegration aspect of bringing them in, because you might even feel that, teachers might, in a sense, not have the same sort of, necessarily kind of engagement with that particular student. Once you've left the system, you and I'm not saying it of all teachers, a teacher might begin to say, well, I had 50 students, I've now got 43. It's something I can handle, rather than pursue an aspect of reintegrating people who would make your task more difficult.
Absolutely. I fully agree with you. I think reintegration is the harder part of the equation. Because
you take stances. You even a teacher, exactly, I can assume, would take a particular stance, and say, how much time do I give and how much work do I put in here for somebody who gave up on me anyway?
Or somebody who's deemed not fit to complete an academic stream, for example.
Yeah.
Right? And then what are my options and where do I go? Because there aren't very many.
Mm.
And so reintegration into school kind of just becomes futile. And in some cases, teachers actually encourage learners and say, don't come back, because it's not going to work for you.
Which is what I was just hinting just here.
Yes, exactly. Now, we do have instances of that. I mean, we have learners who report that to us, where they say that the teacher said I shouldn't come back.
Mm.
I think there are, before grade 10, I think it's a little easier because in our country, the policy is that is the compulsory school going age. It's 16 or grade 9. Mm. So there is some kind of, legislative responsibility to keep learners in school until they are 16 years old, which is punishable by law. So this seems to be real kind of, because of the fear of the consequence, there seems to be real kind of support for if a learner wants to come back before their age.
Yeah.
We do see, though, that for learners who are older, they have a harder struggle even transferring to another school, especially if they're grade 10 and perhaps they've, repeated a grade in the one school and they want to go to another school to avoid the humiliation of the repetition. They find it really difficult to transfer between schools in the grade 10 year or after grade 10. So that does become a problem. And often to those learners, the option is given to do a FEP course outside of the school space, which not many learners take up, because often that incurs costs, and in many schools there's no fees that needs to be paid, right? In FET spaces, which are colleges or TVET colleges, for example, there often are costs that are incurred. That's one. Two, entry is also hindered by the fact that many TVETs actually are biased towards applicants with a matric.
Okay.
So instead of actually serving the learners who are in that FET space, they actually serve as learners who have already completed school to come into those spaces and do, a entry-level college course. And then the other thing is that learners often come back and do the second chance matric program, which doesn't require you to have a particular grade. You can come back If you've completed grade 9 and you can register for the second chance matric program and write that exam without attending school in the formal sense, but by doing self-study or attending kind of like district-provided night school classes or Saturday classes on particular subjects so that you can write the actual subject for your matric certificate, right? We see a lot of learners. I think there's about 700,000, 800,000 every year in that second chance program. Coming back to write that matric exam just so that they can have access to matric certificate. I was going to say that we see that there's a lot of difficulty also then that often when a learner has gained entry into the school to maintain the grip on that entry. Because remember, it's difficult to re-engage. There's a lot of extra support required. So learners who do have extra support in the form of tutors, you know, support services, in terms of social support, for example, maybe they work within a group system, they do better with the reintegration. And I can see this, particularly we've seen this with our learners who are mothering learners who became pregnant in school, dropped out, had their babies, and wanted to return to school as mothering learners. With that kind of supportive structure in place, many of them do complete school and matriculate. With the absence of that supportive structure, though, it's really hard to reintegrate and hold grip on schooling. It's actually you are more likely to drop out again, especially if that support is not in place.
When we start talking about these interventions that one does have to make and early detection of somebody who, you know, who's heading the way of dropping out, are there any test models, any models out there that we could latch on or that we do latch on to that begin to talk about, you know, how we go about this, you know, and it's maybe it's not a budgetary element, but maybe there are aspects in the world and lessons in the world and lessons maybe, you know, elsewhere that we could just pick up and take forward and begin to engage with?
Absolutely. One of the simplest things, and I think that some of the organizations that have been working on the front lines with us in Western Cape, KZN, and Eastern Cape have been doing this very well. It's just institutionalizing attendance tracking. And it sounds very simple, right? Of course you have to track attendance, but I think doing it in a way in which, you know, once a learner has unexcused absence, there's an immediate follow-up. In many of our schools, that system doesn't exist. And so the use of, you know, sometimes community members to go out and knock on doors actually and report back to the school on where this child is, if they've managed to find them, and what's been reported as to why the child hasn't come to school, critical. Because we don't have that information. There's a lot of distance between our household and classrooms if there is no contact. And so, and there's not a lot of time for teachers to be able to do that. What we do find out in those moments is the things that is impacting the learner's disengagement in that time. You know, absenteeism is the first thing that spikes. Usually a learner will come and then, you know, just disappear. You know, frantically miss school for a couple of days and then come back and then miss school for a couple of days. And it's those patterns that we need to pick up. The second thing is when learners are becoming disengaged or disruptive. So disengaged in the sense of they can't concentrate in class. They're really not participating. You know, they're not actually engaging with the classroom content or with anyone else in the class, for example. That's a key telltale sign that there's something happening. There's a withdrawal happening within that learner. We do have quiet learners. But when a learner becomes so withdrawn, you know, that it raises a red flag, that's definitely something we can pick up.
Sure.
And then also disruptive learners. So disruptive learners, the ones who are making noise or disturbing everyone else, there's a reason, you know, why they are acting out in that way. And so understanding what that is. And when we start asking the questions and really investigating and analyzing what is causing this behavior, what is causing the absenteeism, what is causing the behavior, we get to the bottom of what intervention is needed.
Sure.
And because often we are so overwhelmed by the crisis of all of these instances, because there are so many of these instances in classrooms all the time, we don't really track it anymore. And we say, ach, we throw our hands up and we say, ach, these children, there's nothing we can do for them. But we found that once we start tracking these indicators very intentionally, and we have created a tool that we use in schools that is based on the UNICEF early warning system tool that's used globally, And really just track these indicators over time. You can see the risk of your classroom either increasing or decreasing, and you can see individual learner risk. And it spikes, the tool spikes to you and says, it goes red and it says, okay, this learner needs help now. Or it goes orange and it says, you know, put them on your radar. Or it goes green and says, okay, there's nothing, there's no red flags that are picked up for this learner. And I think just doing that intentionally gives us the language and the capacity to advocate for our learners in a different way. So we're not saying all our learners are a problem, and we're not saying, oh, there's only one that's getting it. We can actually say that in my class, I've got 80 learners, and of the 80, 30 of them are now sitting on my red, you know, on my red batch, and I'm needing to really intervene around that. And I think, you know, once we start critically doing that, interventions start looking different. Because now we're not talking to learners just about, you know, we need to be obedient in class and we need to listen. We can unpack with learners that over the past 2 weeks, I've seen more instances of absenteeism. Let's talk about what's going on.
Sure.
And that's a completely different conversation to have in a classroom than to say to learners, you guys are not committed and you don't want to finish school and I come and you don't come and nothing's gonna, you're not going to amount to anything. You know, it's a completely different way of having a conversation around the same behavior that might be problematic. But thinking about how we're solving it from a place of really wanting to understand why it's occurring so we can respond and prevent the eventual dropout.
Merlin, it's been an absolute interesting conversation, but I do want to just know a little bit about Zero Dropout, the Zero Dropout campaign. And you're a director there. Just give us some insight into what you guys do and location is important as well and who else you're working with in this particular space.
Thanks, Denzel. I really enjoyed the conversation as well. So the campaign is a national advocacy campaign. We work with some implementing partners in Western Cape, Eastern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, Northern Cape and Free State, and soon in Gauteng.
When you're here, let's have coffee. let's talk about what you're doing.
We absolutely have to. Our key advocacy agenda is to do policy change, right? And so we want to institutionalize dropout prevention in policy. And to do that, we are, you know, testing interventions on the ground. We actually are showing what it, or demonstrating what it takes to keep a child in school. And so working with these organizations, with the support of the DG Mary Trust, we are able to test some interventions. We're able to really surface some lessons. And we publish research as well as best practice tools that are freely available for download on our website. And we often have engaging town halls on Twitter. So we do one every month on different issues that impact
on Twitter.
Dropout. Yes, Twitter Live.
Sure.
Or Twitter Spaces.
Yeah.
Twitter Live sounds terrible. Twitter Spaces, where we invite just South Africans to come and share with us, and particularly young people to come and share with us what their journeys through
school is. And the Twitter handle there would be?
At ZeroXDropout.
All right. Well, Mansfield, I'm going to say thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Denzel. It was lovely being on the show.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.